seems awkward, and the world is enormous, but I feel like I'm moving at the pace of a tortoise. I need a little patience, but I'm too tempted to flirt with temptation. Black or Caucasian, decide your own process of elimination. It ain't a black or a white thing, left wing, right wing, just trying to do the right thing. I think about the less fortunate, and bless all of us, get the torturous. I don't trust the media, because they take us for idiots. Spell up the dominant, end the conflict, let's get on with it.
Kevin Galilee. Kevin, keep going, mate. I'm very keen.
Yes. Now, the Bretton Woods order gave the U.S. dollar a central role as the currency of global trade. There was no such thing before. To engage in international trade, every nation needed from that moment on to buy dollars before it could buy goods, resources, or services from other nations. And the U.S. dollar was became the reserve currency of choice, the international currency. And the United States, as a result of that, needed to print more money than any other nation on earth in order to satisfy the global demand for its dollars, which was necessary for all these international transactions. But this proved to be a problem because every dollar issued had to be backed up with gold, as was demanded at that time by the so-called gold exchange standard, which was also agreed upon, by the way, at Bretton Woods. And according to this arrangement, countries fixed their exchange rates relative to the U.S. dollar, and central banks could exchange their dollar holdings into gold at the official exchange rate of $35 per ounce, so that all currencies, in effect, were pegged to the dollar and had a fixed value in terms of gold. So gold, therefore, was the standard by which to measure the value of money and by which to ensure that the value is not diluted. But in time, this is what happened. They ran into trouble because the burden on the United States to back up with gold these vast amounts of dollars that it issued in order to facilitate global trade became too great for the United States. And the U.S. was forced to abandon the gold standard. And since then, currencies became detached from gold, thus from any fixed asset. And these are what we now have come to know as fiat money, which means money with no intrinsic value because it's paper. But all currencies in the world now are fiat money. And there is, you know, I hear a lot of talk nowadays in the alternative media and even among, you know, dim-witted economists about a return to the gold standard. And the evil machinations of bankers who assert the value of the dollar, who emptied the vaults of the Federal Reserve of gold bullion and so on. But this talk is complete nonsense, and I'll explain why. This talk is complete nonsense because it is nurtured to detract people from understanding the world around them and to blame imagined culprits for the hardships that we are going through as a result of being, you know, in the middle of this the greatest transition in human history, which is a transition from national self-determination to global government and from national economies to a global economy. This is the biggest transition in history. It's unprecedented, and it has never been done before. The notion that fiat currencies can be abandoned for a return to the gold standard is completely retarded, and I'm sorry to say this, for the simple reason that we would need the gold of three planets to back up the value of all currencies which represent the value of each nation's entire economic activity. It's impossible. Fiat currencies came into being in the early 1970s for the very reason that there was insufficient gold to ensure the convertibility of the U.S. dollar and also the Deutschmark, by the way, which were the two primary reserve currencies of the world, to gold. They could no longer convert these two world currencies to gold. There was just not enough gold to go around. Besides, no single precious metal is available, actually. Nevertheless, gold. No single precious metal is available in quantities large enough to be equivalent in value to the entire economic output of the world. And this shortage of metals is forcing nations now to even abandon small coins, because the cost of the material itself, which is copper, is, you know, one of the main ingredients in coins, has become too precious. And it can be better used in other things, because it's a conductor of electricity and whatnot. So the value of these metals that go into the coins is greater than the value of the smallest denomination coins, which is why all of these small coins are being abandoned elsewhere. Because this metal is so valuable and so precious, it can be put to better use elsewhere. So never mind that we cannot return to a gold standard or even a silver standard. We can't even get enough copper, for God's sake, to keep producing all these small coins. Now, you have to also remember that while gold output growth since 1950 has kept pace with world population growth, because they have both doubled, it has fallen behind world economic growth by at least 8 times. In other words, the economy has grown 8 times faster in the past 60 years than the amount of gold that we extract from the ground, which is why we had to abandon the gold standard in the 70s. When this, you know, this huge discrepancy became painfully evident. So the skeptics who argue that the value of gold could be artificially raised to equal that of all economic output, this is complete idiocy, because in that case, a gold bar would have to cost millions of dollars or yen or euros. So why bother doing that? If you can agree to accept, you know, the artificial valuation of gold to such exorbitant sums of money, then why not agree to accept the artificial value of paper? Or straw, or cow dung, for that matter. So fiat currencies recognize this conundrum, and they spare us from having to amass these unimaginable quantities of gold and then stockpile them in the vaults of central banks to just sit there for nothing, in perpetuity, to no good at all, which is a complete waste of human and material resources. So you see, money has no intrinsic value other than what is agreed upon by convention.
Well, this is the exact same reason why the original gold holders and things of that nature started to write out gold receipts instead, because lugging around bags of gold became impractical, and that was the very beginning of fiat money. They realized thousands of years ago, at the time before gold was even frickin' started to be seen as something you wouldn't really want to be having around in your pocket, they realized even then that fiat currency was a better system.
And they needed them for international transactions, for, you know, long distance trade. Yes, of course. It's a logical solution to a physical problem, to a real problem. So now the money today has no intrinsic value other than what is agreed upon by convention. And to agree upon the value of money requires trust in the system, but also requires faithful and universal respect for this system, for its rules, by every nation on earth. This is why no nation on earth is allowed to break this system, because this is what fundamentally, essentially maintains the peace. If this system breaks down, this monetary system, this monetary coercion system, then countries will not be able to access resources that are you know, absolutely necessary, and then they have to go to war to take by force what they can't access by purchasing them.
And they do.
Yes, they do. So, but this, there's several problems with this too. Let me just continue explaining here. What is required in this system, right, is trust. This is entirely built on trust, not on hoarding gold, you know, in a vault and sitting on it and saying, yeah, look, you can trust me. I got all this gold here. Come and look at it. Trust, that's all that matters in this system. And the ability to agree and to consent that we respect the value of this money and we respect each other's money. But then the next logical step in this process is to do away with physical money altogether, which is exactly what is happening and has been happening increasingly since the end of World War II. Because you have to keep in mind that the vast majority of financial transactions nowadays and for the past 30 years occur electronically and not by physically transferring large quantities of money, you know, be it coins or banknotes. So they occur by physical
transfer. Except if you're the CIA or a major cocaine dealer.
Yes, but that's beside the point.
But the CIA are major cocaine dealers, so that kind of cancels each other out. I'm sorry, Kevin, keep going.
They're the only ones still dealing with, you know, in truckloads of cash still. So nowadays, all these huge transfers of money for international transactions occur electronically, and it's just points on a computer screen. That is how money is being moved from one jurisdiction to another, back and forth, back and forth. Physical money covers only a very, very small percentage of the overall economic activity. So that's why we're well on our way to being a cashless society. We are already, probably to the tune of 60%, a cashless society. All we have to do is accept the inevitable that we're going to move towards a digital global currency. And whatever physical currency is going to remain in place, it's going to be there only in case we're going to have some kind of meltdown of our computers and telecommunications network. But the advantages of this, you know, are great. There's no point discussing them right now because it doesn't fall within the ambit of this program. But this is where we're moving towards a cashless society with a global digital currency, and there's, you know, the IMF and the Chinese and the Russians and everybody else already screaming, and this is what we need.
And everybody will have a microchip with all their money on it, so if you get out of line with the bankers, they can just turn your chip off. Then you can't buy nothing, including food.
That's very interesting, because you see, once you have a cashless society, once you have a digital currency, right, built entirely on trust, you have to be able to distribute that money properly. So that means every human being has to be counted, has to be accessible, right? Has to be able to access the international monetary system. So it has to be part of the system. Otherwise, he or she will not be able to get the points, the electronic points necessary to purchase what they need. So that's why they want to have either some kind of face recognition technology or iris recognition, or, you know, implanting some kind of a chip, or we have a card, you know, a data card carrying with us that is that has all the data necessary, or the fingerprint and so on. And this is coming. It's coming. That's why it's so important now that we get control of the global governance level, so that this power is not manipulated and abused, and they're turning us into a complete sheep then. But there are tremendous advantages to a digital currency, and it is coming. The moves have already been made. What I want to explain, because it's very, very rather complicated, is that what the international community has accomplished so far, and, you know, what the overarching great goals of this globalization depopulation policy or world order axis have been, and they are three. The goals that they have accomplished, that they have pursued, and they're still being pursued because some of them are not fully accomplished. Now I'll explain our three. One is economic integration. Two is political centralization, and three is the demographic transition. And these are at the absolute core of the international community. Let's start with number one, economic integration. Well, to achieve economic integration, we have seen that they had to put together an international monetary system, that they had to accept each other's currencies, that they had to tie each other's currency to the U.S. dollar, that they had to facilitate free trade across borders, that in order to avoid taking resources by force and so on. So to achieve economic integration, what is required now is the impoverishment of the West, in a sense, and the enrichment of the rest. And this is a process that is ongoing and that transfers jobs, capital, and know-how from the developed world, where the population has started to shrink already, to the developing world, where the population is still growing. And this has robbed us in the West of economic stability and employment opportunities, and it has also robbed the developing world of control over their resources and of their native systems of social, of political, of economic, and of cultural organization. Because if the rest of the world is to function within this system, is to have, you know, currencies that have value, they have to have economies that are produced. And in order to produce anything competitive on this international market, you have to be able to compete with the West. That means you have to adopt the same kind of manufacturing techniques, the same kind of technology, and so on, and work, you know, 9-to-5 jobs. And the vast majority of the world is not used to this kind of lifestyle. This kind of lifestyle is dictated by the technology, by the consumers, the consumer goods that we produce and consume. So what is in effect now occurring is a giant and global act of restitution by the West towards the rest. If you want a restitution for the sins of our fathers and forefathers, you know, sins committed during past centuries, slavery, colonialism, conquest, exploitations, sins that have led to an unbridgeable wealth gap between the West and the rest. A wealth gap, by the way, that also developed because we were the first, we in the West were the first to industrialize. So had we in the West, you know, been asked to voluntarily pay restitution to the world for the sins of our fathers, and had our counterparts in the people in the non-Western world been asked to abandon the traditional ways of life for Western affluence, we and they would have undoubtedly refused. That is why we were never asked. And yet, you cannot have an international system based on monetary coercion and on, you know, monetary a uniform economic system that allows everybody to access resources without homogenizing the world in this respect, at least in terms of economics, which is why economics has been, you know, at the forefront of global change. And this is why we have learned to hate bankers and the banks and debt and so on. So in the current context, the restitution that we in the West are paying is necessary to equalize wealth to an extent that is sufficient to achieve global monetary convergence. You cannot have global monetary convergence. You cannot have a global digital currency. You cannot have that unless most all regions of the world have, you know, similar standards of living and similar rules and procedures and standards.
Yeah, because you can hardly expect somebody in a slum in Rio de Janeiro to be expected to have a cell phone, smartphone with a slash card chip and everything, right? When they don't even have running water.
And you can hardly expect an agrarian society, you know, to trade on the international markets. They would have nothing to trade, nothing of value. They might trade a few potatoes, but that's not going to, you know, pay the bills or allow them to access oil, which is expensive, and other, you know, dwindling resources. That's why they're hurrying now. You know, like it's a crazy rush towards homogenizing, towards bringing the world, you know, to a similar standard of living. So they are decreasing our standard of living in order to reduce our consumption levels. They are increasing the standard of living of the developing world. And in such a way, you know, they're coming up in their consumption levels, we're coming down, and we're reaching, you know, sort of a similar standard of living, which is why our generation in the West now is the first one ever to be poorer than our parents. Because this has been engineered. This, you know, this impoverishment has been engineered in order to achieve this this monetary convergence and in order for the world to have, you know, more sensible consumption patterns. And in order to close the gap between the huge consumption levels of the West, because we used to consume, you know, 40 times more resources here in North America than, let's say, people in Africa, and 20 times more than people in Asia. But this gap is closing, you know, relatively fast. So in the current context, the restitution that we are paying is necessary to equalize wealth to an extent that is sufficient to achieve global monetary convergence, which we need desperately. We need desperately for another reason. Why? As technology improves and advances, as digitization takes over, you know, jobs, replaces humans in the manufacturing process, more and more human beings are going to be displaced from the labor market. And the economy cannot employ people. Even though now, you know, they're trying to find farfaluting ways of employing people in the service economy. We have all these useless jobs and useless, you know, businesses in the service economy that are replicated all over the place. You know, gazillion different kinds of hamburger joints and that sort of stuff. They cannot employ people because people are displaced by these advanced manufacturing techniques. Now they can the economy can produce more and more and more goods with fewer and fewer and fewer people at a time when the population is still increasing. So unemployment has become chronic and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. But how do you allow people in a fully monetized economy, right, which is all the industrial countries, all countries in the world and all societies in the world, with the exception of agrarian societies, are fully monetized economies. People cannot survive in these environments unless they have a job. And now the economies, the society cannot offer jobs to people. So what do? This is why now you have, in the United States, 45 million people on food stamps and, money that is being given by the government, if you want, because these people cannot be employed. And more people will not be able to be employed. So now we need a fast transition, a desperate transition to a global currency, because only a global currency can enable the distribution of enough points, of enough money, for people who are no longer employed and they will never be employed to survive, to buy the necessary goods and services to survive despite being unemployed, despite not being productive members of society. It's a completely unprecedented situation. We've never had that before.
We've never had people trying to dumb down the global population and reduce its fertility before either.
Yes.
Maybe it's an unintended consequence. Maybe there used to be an entrepreneurial spirit within people and the ability to be independent and think for themselves and create jobs themselves. Now they need an employer or a government to do it for them because they've lost that ability.
But, even at the best of times, Vinny, before, we were poisoned to stupidity and apathy, even at the best of times, entrepreneurs were a very small minority of the population. It takes guts and it takes initiative and it takes intelligence and it takes courage and many other things to be an entrepreneur and succeed at it. Most people, they just want to work and they don't want to have to worry. They want to come home and, at 5 o'clock, hang their hat, plant their butt on the couch and watch TV and eat potato chips. That's what most people want. Anyway, to be an entrepreneur, to run your own business, means you're going to have to work day and night. And you have all the responsibility on your shoulders and so on. And most people don't want that kind of responsibility. That's a reality we have to face.
That's true.
Now, to go back to the difficult explanations I was going through, analysis, if you want. What this form of economic convergence requires, requires that developing nations abandon their traditional forms of social, economic, and political organization, and that they adopt, in a sense, Western standards. They adopt, this Western standard of living, this Western mode of living, which depends on technology, on manufacturing, on science, because that is what will provide the affluence necessary to compete for those resources on the international market, all of these people aspire. Everybody in the world, in the developing world, aspires to have Western standards of living, but they have no clue what that entails. They don't know the high cost and sacrifices of a Western type life. They don't know you have to work 9 to 5 and you have to be a slave to the economy and you have to move wherever the jobs are and so on. So this is why everybody in the developing world is screaming, you are destroying our societies, you're tearing us apart, we don't want your Western lifestyle, but they want the Western goods, they want the affluence, and they need to access oil, and they need to access resources in order to obtain this affluence. So you see that, we're blaming each other here, when in fact our problems are so deep, and they're caused by, structural problems, by outdated systems, by the fact that we have this readjustment of an economy from an economy of nation states to a global economy, and on and on and on. There's so many factors here involved. Now, political centralization. This is the other huge objective that has been pursued little by little, and actually by necessity, because you cannot agree on global rules of trade and so on without having some form of political discussions or some kind of forum where you can make the political decisions and come to an agreement internationally. So political centralization is in effect a byproduct, or was necessitated by by this economic integration that has been pursued. But to achieve political centralization, which is a process that is still ongoing and is by no means complete, has required divesting national assemblies of power and investing international organizations with the authority to dictate to national assemblies. And this has robbed us, you know, citizens, voters, has robbed us of the right to self-determination, at least in many aspects of our lives, especially international trade.
It's kind of like a Venus flytrap in a way. It's got something nice and sticky and gooey that everybody loves the smell of, and as soon as they get there, it slowly closes and digests you. Kevin Galilee is my guest, and we'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. com. We're sponsored, of course, by The Range of Illusion, a Provinces novel by B. Holmes, a story of secrecy, a saga of the self, a citizen's search for truth. Also, another book on the website, we have The Crowdfunding Revolution by Kevin Lawton. We've done an interview and a YouTube video with him there as well. I encourage you to check that out. Plus, check out the affiliates, Rush FM, that has stations in New Zealand from Auckland down to Tauranga and Taupo. So check that out on the home site there. And Ifinity FM for the South Island listeners. And also remember our sponsors, the High Tea Cafe, and especially that gourmet soap kitchen. Keep yourselves clean in a dirty, filthy world, ladies and gentlemen, for that gourmet soap kitchen in Wagga Wagga. And she's a lovely lady. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. You got to love this place. Kevin was elaborating there about certain economic, political, and centralisation processes going on, and I see that just happening here in New Zealand. We've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that's going to bind all of our nations to the rule of corporations. We've had the Super City legislation, which has bound 9 different independent local councils around the Auckland region into one all-powerful council with the Lord Mayor, who gets to pick his hand-picked unelected cabinet, which is incidentally shelling out all of the city's resources into private contracting, incidentally run by people who are beneficiaries of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. So you see the centralization, you see this call for unionization, and this is going to allow us to slot nicely into this new world order that we're talking about, or the scumbaggery world order, as I like to call it. Kevin, welcome back.
Yes, if I may continue with the political centralization process, as I was explaining, the national assemblies have been divested of power, at least in certain jurisdictions, and international organizations have been invested with power that formerly belonged to national assemblies. And that was necessary, was necessitated by the fact that all of these countries, you know, 193 countries, had to find a common set of rules, had to find common ground to trade internationally, to keep the peace, to talk to each other, to solve problems. Now, of course, the problems run into all kinds of gamuts, even environmental, not just economic, political, and so on, military. And how do you do that? You know, obviously, you have to designate certain issues, international security prerogatives, say, and then you send, as a country, you send a few representatives to push for the interests of your country, but at the same time, to discuss the global issues and come to an agreement with all the other member states. So now they've created by necessity an international political infrastructure. And this international political infrastructure has robbed us, you know, nation states, of self-determination in specific areas. And that is why democracy has been replaced with plutocracy. That is to say, the rule of the people has been displaced by the rule of a dominant minority. And it was not necessarily because it was intended that way. It's out of need. Imagine you have 193 countries now, and if you were to send all of the MPs, all of the members of parliament of every country to this international forum, to this international government, if you want, it would be complete mayhem. You would have, you know, tens of thousands of politicians trying to reach consensus on something. So obviously, it's not practical. You cannot work that way. So it was by necessity that this, you know, that the international superstructure became plutocratic rather than democratic, or at the very least, so limited in its membership that is, you know, even though democratic about between the few members, the privileged members who are representing the countries there, it's not democratic for the rest of us because we don't have a voice there. And yet, this political centralization is necessary in order to complete the transition from a world organized according to the interests of nation states to a world organized around common global interests. Without the political and institutional infrastructure to carry out this process, there can be no coordinated and peaceful action. And humanity will forever remain separated by artificial borders and incapable of solving the material, the environmental, the political problems that threaten our very existence. The reality is that the will to accomplish global unity could not have been initiated, let alone coordinated, by the national assemblies of the world's 200 or some countries, all of them independent nation states, all of them with their own interests and with their own problems, narrow problems compared to the international problems. So someone had to forge ahead, and the elites did. Had we been asked to give up our hard-earned democracy for the dictates of global authorities that, although consensual in their decision-making process, are so limited in membership as to constitute plutocracy or UN autocracy for the rest of us, we would have never conceded. And that is why we were never asked. So this is, you know, this political centralization is as much the result of tactical requirements, if you want, as it is the result of the need to reduce the number of participants in order to come to some kind of conclusion. Because you cannot have a discussion between 100,000 politicians. You have to restrict it to a very limited group. People can only interact with so many people. And that is the process of political centralization. But what this political centralization has allowed the world is to have now sort of concentric circles of jurisdiction. Now you have now the international governance level with their own areas of jurisdiction. And then you have the national governments with their own areas of jurisdiction. And then you have the regional ones, and then you have the local ones. And they try to stay out of each other's way so that things work smoothly. And the fact that you have this separation of power, you know, from the international superstructure to the national, to the regional, to the local, this is what enables the people at the global governance level to pull strings and to force, you know, national assemblies to do what they want them to do despite the voters' interests and the voters' complaints and objections. And yet that is the only way you're going to keep the peace between all of these nations, all of them with their conflicting cultures and political systems and, you know, histories and animosities towards others and so on. has been a very, very difficult process. But here we are, and for better or worse, you know, they are keeping the peace. And the best thing we can hope for is, and we have to do now, is to make sure that we get control of the global governance level, that we democratize that. And now that it is in place, we can do it. The third objective of the international community, which is, you know, the most difficult, because it's the one that has required the most immoral, unethical, criminal decisions, if you want, is the demographic limitations that they had to impose on the world, because we live on a planet with finite resources. There are no new continents to discover. We cannot send our excess population anywhere, you know, to open up new agricultural fields and to populate, you know, new continents. They don't exist. So the demographic limitations. Now we've reached the limits of the planet, and now we have to learn how to live within those limits. And in order to do that, they knew there was no other way but to make sure that the population stops growing.
Well,
and since we have already outgrown our resources, they have to ensure that the population shrinks.
Mm.
So to ensure that we break free from the cycle of poverty, that we live within the planet's ability to regenerate itself, and that we don't resort to wars or necessity, which is what has trapped us, you know, for millennia in conflict, followed by conflict, followed by conflict, and that we don't exhaust the world's resources that belong to future generations, and that we also leave behind a world that is, you know, clean and with a healthy environment, not a world denuded to our children and to future generations. And that we, to ensure that we restore balance between nature and human civilization, all of this has required that we undergo a brutal process of defusing the population bomb and shrinking our numbers. And this process started in 1945 and is ongoing, and everything, absolutely everything, including our survival, hinges on its completion. And this process is euphemistically known as the demographic transition. And at its core, it is at the core of the international community, because it represents the obverse and the hidden side of globalization. And what this process requires in order to reverse population growth and stabilize the global population, which is a completely unnatural process, as I had explained, what this process requires is our covert, our secret poisoning with chemical, biological, bacteriological agents that cause mass sterility and selective morbidity. This process also requires psychosocial and economic manipulations that undermine the family structure so as to suppress and inhibit the formation of large families. That's why we no longer have, you know, families with 10 children, like used to be the case. And this process has done untold damage to the genetic and intellectual endowment of humanity. This process has come to be covert and heartless because insurmountable obstacles stood in the way of legislating family size. And I explained those insurmountable obstacles, you know, in my books and in our previous interviews. But to make a long story short, there were three. In 1945, there were no birth control methods available. The political process, the democratic process, made it impossible for politicians to stand in front of the electorate and say, if you elect me, you know, I'm going to introduce population control and limit your family size. No politician would get elected on a platform like that. So that was the second insurmountable obstacle. And the third one was the intractability of religious authorities, and especially the Catholic Church, which committed itself early on to an absolutely no contraceptives. We don't allow the use of contraceptives, we don't allow abortion, and so on. And I can understand, you know, the reluctance to abort, and I'm fully on board there in this respect with the Catholic Church, but there's absolutely no need to stand in the way of legitimizing and encouraging the use of contraceptives. So those three insurmountable obstacles stood in the way to legislation. So that's why they drove the depopulation, a population control program, underground. It was driven underground by these three structural obstacles, not because there are some demonic group of, you know, of skull and bones fellows who were who are scheming behind the scenes there to kill humanity. That's not it. The world is a lot more complex than that. But this process of engineered demographic transition requires a subtle form of infanticide as well as a subtle form of matricide and patricide. This process has prevented the birth of 2 billion children, and it is about to speed up the death of 3 billion people. Brutal numbers, brutal goals. Had we been asked to give up our reproductive rights, to downgrade the intellectual and genetic endowments of our children, to condemn our parents and ourselves to illness and premature death in order to accomplish this demographic transition, we would have never agreed. And that is why we were never asked. That is why we were never asked. And that is why they're trying to keep this secret, because they have not accomplished the goal yet. The demographic transition is not accomplished. We are in phase four of the demographic transition, the last phase in the developed world. But in the developing world, they've just barely entered phase two. They are 50 years behind us.
It seems that they have no faith in us.
No, they don't. And also because they find that it is a lot easier to operate with just a limited number of insiders rather than try to convince and educate, 7 billion people, which would be an ongoing process. And they would have to dedicate, tremendous resources to educate the public and to reach consensus. So they said no once the process was going anyway, because it was driven underground due to these structural obstacles I just described. The system was set in place, and it was much easier to just continue as they have done since 1945 rather than change course. And of course, they would never change course. These bureaucracies, unless forced into changing course, because these bureaucracies, they have a life of their own. There's a lot of vested interest. That's the way they're doing things. And to change a global system that operates on a need-to-know basis is just it would be a complete nightmare, right? And you cannot really change it. You have to completely rebuild it. You have to dismantle what is and, rebuild a new system that operates on a completely different premise, which is openness rather than secrecy. The existing system operates on secrecy. It depends on it. It's that is its most vital component. And now it's like changing, night into day. Now they have to operate according to openness and consensus and education rather than secrecy and, behind the door agreements between a plutocratic minority and deception of the general public. So very difficult transition, but we are forcing it upon them because there is no bloody way I'm going to allow them to poison my children into stupidity and sterility. We are far smarter than that. And if I can come to all these secrets on my own, and I have absolutely no training in economics or politics, and I'm an art historian, an architectural historian. That's what I do. I guess I discovered all this, and I have been able to patch together this complex puzzle because I'm a historian and I can look at the past. See, somebody who's caught in the present cannot see where we came from, cannot see all these long term trends, because they're used to just looking, in their immediate surrounding and just analyzing the world according to what has happened for the past 10 years and what they think might happen in the next 5 years. So I guess it took a historian to do this, and here I am. But all these three achievements, economic integration, political centralization, and demographic transition, are the result of conscious decisions made by policymakers, not bankers. Bankers are just a small part of this. They're just responsible for the economic section of this global plan that incorporates every aspect of life: politics, economics, culture, communication, everything. All of these three goals are largely the result of consensus, not force. Consensus among the elites, because it was much easier to reach consensus on these difficult issues amongst a small group rather than, involving the entire population. So the masses have been excluded in order to simplify and speed up this process, to make it efficient, but also in order to bypass democratic oversight and structural and systemic obstacles. And they had to bypass democratic oversight because it would have been impossible to get the assemblies of 200 nations to agree on these common denominators and the common plan. They would have been bickering and bitching and complaining and fighting back and forth over little details, and they would have lost themselves in the forest and would have accomplished absolutely nothing. So all of these three accomplishments are the result of deep, deep cooperation between professional groups that span every field of knowledge and every area of competence, and who have agreed to forge ahead under the cover of secrecy and by deception, knowing that it would be too difficult to talk sense into the masses, since few people have the intelligence to comprehend the complex issues, and everybody, or most everybody, lacks the time necessary to study the situation, and most people lack the desire to want to understand or to even want to have a role in forging the future.
Well, they could repeat it over and over. Continue, Kevin.
Most of us, let's face it, care only for immediate gratification, for fun in the present, you know, for having a good time with your neighbors and buddies and so on. And we give little consideration to the future. And these people have been asked to consider, they've been forced to consider the future of humanity 200 years in advance.
Well, I was going to suggest that they could indeed brainwash people through the media by repeating it over and over and over again, all the way out through all the channels every now and again, and use that to make everybody think that depopulation is a really good idea. So then when any voting or legislation or anything comes around, everybody would be totally happy to accept it. It'd be cool. It'd be part of the norm.
Well, you know something, this issue depopulation runs very deep, because once you go down to the core of it, it involves allowing the government or authorities a place in your bedroom. You know, nobody wants to be regulated in their sexual activities, right, by anybody. This is a matter between husband and wife, and, you know, nobody wants a third wheel there saying, you know, hold on there, dude, keep it in your pants, not tonight. Sorry, you cannot have a kid, you know, for the next 5 years. Sorry, you cannot have no more than two kids, because that's the situation, the global situation, right? You see, this goes down to our to the most basic and one of the most powerful instincts, the urge to procreate, and we all know how difficult that urge is to control.
Oh yeah, but we've got pornography all over the place, so people are getting their sexual jollies without even having sex or even anywhere near like that. A man could easily spend his life never within reach of a woman and never go without one.
Yeah, and now that is possible now, because they've made sure that, you know, there is pornography available, so people can have release, if you want relief. You know, in 1945, if you even talk about anything that's even remotely sexual, you would have been booked immediately in prison for under obscenity laws.
Ironically,
it's a different environment now. Now we can talk about these issues. Now this is considered a health issue, no longer an ethical issue.
You know, it reminds me of a Brave New World, because there's another consequence of this. Is not only do people maybe some people potentially have even less sex and have less desire for real sex as a result of proliferation of pornography, but there's also increased element possibly of promiscuity, so it would also increase sex for some and decrease it for others. So at the end of the day, you still need mitigating factors according to this philosophy of population reduction, don't you? Regardless.
Well, yes, and regardless of whether you fall under the category of a person with an increased sexual appetite because of this, everybody is far less capable of producing children, because our sperm is substandard than previous generations were, who had not been interfered with through covert chemical and biological methods. So, you know, even though people may have sex now more often than in the past, which I doubt that's the case, their sex is going to be fruitless, because it will not result in a childbirth, in conception. So these are the problems. This is how the depopulation policy hangs together or relates to the globalization effort, and therefore to the effort of the international community to maintain peace and to ensure, or at least forge, some kind of semblance of global prosperity and avoid war, so that we don't fall victim to three huge threats: the threat of nuclear annihilation, for one thing; the threat of mass global famine, two; and the third one, the threat of environmental devastation. These are the three threats that are hanging over our heads now, because we are, in effect, victims of our own success as a species. We're so successful. We've displaced every other species on Earth. We don't have any predators. We don't have any enemies. There's nobody to stop us. This is why only man can stop man, and this is why our governments have become our predators in a way. The international community, the United Nations, is the predator, in a sense, of humanity, because they are there to stop humanity from spreading out of control and destroying everything that our lives and all life on Earth depends. So just imagine the paradox, right? This is a paradox of unprecedented proportions. But this is why I keep saying that all of these crimes, all of these horrible, odious crimes, these diabolical methods, have been committed fundamentally with good intentions, with benevolent intentions, not with bad intentions, not with malevolent intentions. Even though it's a very hard concept to grasp, but if they hadn't put together this force to stop humanity, right, we would have already self-destructed because we have nobody to stop us. Those are the realities we face. Now, from now on, from this generation onward, the notion that anybody will be able to have more than two children is going to be completely buried. Large families are done with. We're already at beyond the limits of Mother Earth, and from now on, in perpetuity, for all times, families are going to be restricted to two. And might as well do it voluntarily, because if we don't do it voluntarily, they're going to poison us. And when they poison us, many of us will become completely sterile and will completely disappear. By taking responsibility and voluntarily saying, we're going to do this, stop poisoning us, at least all of us will be able to continue our lineages. No family line need to be terminated. So we will democratize global governance, we will democratize this demographic process of shrinking the population and bringing the human civilization back, in tune, in balance with Mother Nature.
I think we can do it quite easily the same way we've gotten people to stop smoking in Maine. It's just give everybody crap about it all the time,
Vinny, I know people are going to get this. We're not stupid. This is not rocket science. This is not brain surgery. These are relatively simple things to grasp once you have a whole picture. Once we are given the facts and not, being deceived into being ignorant and being confused, because the whole program has been geared towards deception and lies so that they can go ahead and do these things behind our backs, right? Now the entire program has to be geared towards education, consensus, and responsible citizenship, but also towards building this new ethic of a global consciousness. We all have to think now in global terms. In other words, we have to think what is good for the world, for future generations, not just what is good for John and Joe and for the city in which you live. That kind of mentality is completely gone. We can no longer hide behind national borders. We can no longer hide behind, ethnic limitations and behind notions that this is my group and the whole world can go to hell. That mentality has to be buried. Otherwise, we're all going to hell.
Now, also, the world's getting a bit more dangerous place lately, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? You see the threats all around you. It's in your food. It's in the air. It's in the skies. It's on the ground. It's permeated and saturated every facet of our lives. And basically, we're going to be given now one thing we didn't have before all this stuff came around: a choice about whether or not we take responsibility so that these scumbags who are poisoning us no longer feel that they have to. Kevin Galilee has been my very special guest. What's your website there, Kevin, quickly?
People can find me on LinkedIn or on Facebook. Of course, since I've been imprisoned 6 times to stop me from bringing the truth, I have not been able to maintain my personal website. That I'm just, you know, putting back my life together again after 6 imprisonments and 10 months in exile and a year behind bars. But now I have earned, you know, this privileged position of being able to say what nobody in the world can say. No politician, no UN technocrat or bureaucrat. However, if people want to support us, we do need the public support this time here in Rome to complete my task here, to be able to force Pope Francis to speak up. And if anybody wants to donate a few dollars to our fund, I would appreciate it. And the donations link to that is www.gofundme.com/5fqttc. That's gofundme.com/5fqttc. And we don't need a fortune. We just need people to donate a few dollars so that we can stay here for as long as it takes to force Pope Francis to come clean, to change the church's policy, to allow contraceptive use, which would clear the way for secular institutions to bring the population control into the open and encourage people to use contraceptives rather than poison us behind our backs.
Yeah, that's right. Come clean, Pope Francis. Promote the use of condoms. And this episode has been sponsored by the Crowdfunding Revolution, a book by Kevin Lawton and Dan Marum, The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes. Those books are on the websites there. Also, our little friendly sponsors, the High Tea Cafe and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen. Don't forget about Blue Shield as well, because one of the little depopulation methodologies is bathing you in radiation, because that doesn't make your swimmers work too well either. Thank you very much, Kevin Galilee. And also, on a side note, just to ramp up the show here, you posted a comment to me the other day on Facebook. Now, funnily enough, the day before, I'd been driving over to one of my mate's place to have a beer with him, and I was thinking in the car, like, because I don't have a radio, I'm forced to think when I drive. And so I was thinking, when I die, what I want to happen after I die is somebody to come up and say something and have saved a lot of lives, right? Like, saved a good bulk of people. And I want them, after I'm dead, to come up and say something along the lines of, you know, Vinny Eastwood, that guy, he talked to me one time when I was down in the dumps and when I was really feeling like crap and I was going to give up on trying to save people. I just couldn't do it anymore. It had been too much. And then he came along and he talked to me, and he made something that kind of like changed my mind about that. And I went on to save a lot of people's lives. And this is a comment you posted a day after I had that thought. I have the greatest respect for Vinny, and I look forward to our interview. Vinny is the first media person in the world to have the courage to offer me a podium from which to tell the world the bitter truths of the global depopulation policy. Had it not been for him, I may have never broken the ice and could have disappeared into oblivion. Vinny is one of a kind, and the world better start recognizing his extraordinary value. He is worth his weight in gold. No, correction. Diamonds.
And I want to add something to that. You are far more important than any head of state in the world today, as am I, because we are the ones forging a global change. Their hands are tied. They have neither the courage nor the flexibility, because they're caught within the system and they're waiting to be rescued by outsiders. We are the rescue team. We are the salvation. We are the second coming, if you want. That's how important you are, Vinny, and that's how important am I. And people have finally started recognizing this, because this is something very difficult to wrap your head around. There is no book to follow. This is completely new knowledge. This is, and until now, also forbidden fruit.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And also bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this show is listener supported. You are the ones who pay and ensure that this happens. There is only one rule when you donate to me. It doesn't matter how much or whatever you want to do. You can do whatever you want, $1 a month to $100 a month or $1,000, $10,000, whatever. Don't, under any circumstances, donate to me if your family's going hungry and if you don't have all your bills paid. Don't do it. I don't want to see any of you being put out there and actually making your own lives harder just to make my life easier. It defeats the purpose of what I'm trying to do here. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening.